This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, where it's going to be 82 degrees today. I hate to rub this in, but I have a guest who I think is not going to feel 82 degrees today. And I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Jerome Preisler, and the name of his book is Netforce, Moving Target. It is book four in this wonderful series, and I'm so happy that he's joining me today. But I want to announce that we might have an interruption. As all of my listeners know, Eugenia Lovett West is a favorite here on Joy on Paper. She's been an inspiration to many of the listeners because she just turned 100 years old, and 2 years ago, she wrote a book about cybercrime. She did the research, and she did a really wonderful mystery. So if she calls in, we're going to interrupt everything and put her on the line. But now I'm happy to welcome Jerome. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Patsy. We've scratched 20 degrees here, so I only need, 62 to get up to where you are?
Yeah.
And 6 inches of fresh snow.
Oh boy! Yeah. Well, you know that's what happens, and it's you could have another one because, you know, I was born in March on March 28th, and it was one of the biggest snowstorms ever in northern Michigan. So you might have yet more coming your way.
You know, I'm going to blow a secret here. I'm going to disclose something here. Every now and then, Patsy and I touch base via email between times I'm on the show, and she'll always tell me about the manatee and the dolphin in her neck of the woods, and I'm looking at half-starved squirrels trying to get in for warmth. So so this little. Our little banter goes on, even off the air.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm just rubbing it in a little bit. We're so happy because we were freezing here. It went down to 44 degrees a few weeks ago, and I was frozen.
Oh, wow. Awful.
And so I was thinking of you.
If I saw 44, I'd be running out in my bathing suit.
Well, I'm so happy that you're here today to talk about this new book. And, you know, one thing, I'm going to stop right now. I just want to make sure, am I pronouncing your name correctly? You know, we've known each other quite a while. I'm not sure because I've recently had people with, you know, pronouncing their names differently than I expect. So how do you pronounce your last name?
Preisler. Either one works for me.
Preisler.
You're getting it right.
It's Preisler. Because we have in the synagogue, we have like Levins, you know. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, but you know, people figured all this stuff up as they went along anyway.
Well, okay. So, Jerome Preisler.
Yeah, so you've got it.
You've got a wonderful book out today. Well, it was out on Tuesday, and so I wanted to wait 2 days to have you so I could have you for a longer time, because I know whenever you have a pub day, you're always busy with lots of interviews. But it's worth the wait, because I'm going to have you here for the entire hour to talk about the book. And it's just, for me, it was so exciting to get the book, and I love getting it in advance. So tell us about this latest book about, techno thrillers. I mean, they're out at the right time.
Yeah, you know, to be honest, I kind of resist that label because I think that I just really consider it a thriller. And as you know, you've read all the books, I think that it's really kind of a cross genre series. And that really just reflects what I like to read. You know, I read all sorts of books, and I think all of it just kind of goes into the, you know, into the blender. So I think NetForce as a whole, and maybe even this book more than any of the others, really kind of, you know, plays with the boundaries of different genres. And while I obviously, you know what the there are certain foundations or underpinnings that I know are really part of being a series that was co-created by Tom Clancy, and I know what marks I have to hit, and I kind of understand I well understand the framework of that. I think that in this book again, it really moves into some different and interesting areas that I didn't expect. There was one author who was kind enough to say compare it a little bit to Blade Runner, which I thought was interesting because I hadn't thought of it. But then I thought, yeah, actually, it's kind of neat because there are elements of that in there. The Da Vinci Code, and I thought, wow, I hadn't thought of that one either. But yeah, there's a little bit of that in there. So moving target is a lot of things.
And mostly it's just an absolutely fun read, very exciting, lots of action. And of course it starts off in, well, one of our favorite cities, Paris. So
yeah.
So there's so much that you've worked with there. What do you want to tell us about the setting for this? Because you really put a new look on Paris for many people.
Well, we start out with the focus in this book is on my character, Kali Alcazar. And she, throughout the series, I've been really hinting at a backstory for Kali. I present her in book one, Dark Web, as almost a lone wolf, gray hat hacker, someone who does things according to her own set of moral codes and principles. But even in that book, I knew that there were bigger things in store for her, and I hinted at Kali being part of something that was a lot more than what amounts to her own code, and in this book that really comes to fruition. So, Kali's closest friend has disappeared in Paris, and we open the story with Kali in Paris. She's disappears at the end of the previous book, Threat Point. And it picks up. This picks up days later. She's in Paris, and she's looking for her best friend, who she believes to be hiding in the what's known as the catacombs beneath Paris. And I say what's known as because catacombs really connote, you know, burial and tomb. But only a small section of the tunnels beneath Paris are catacombs. I believe it's something like 1.4 miles or thereabouts, and there are 200 miles of tunnels beneath the streets of Paris. Many people don't know that. The 1-point-something miles that are the catacombs are open to the public, and there are guided tours, and they've been open, I believe, since around the time of Napoleon, who created them as a tourist attraction after seeing something similar in Rome. But but here we're dealing with the rest of it. What is the rest of that 200 miles look like? And Kali knows her friend is somewhere down there. She's hunting for him at the same time as there are people who are hunting for her, as well as her friend. And those people are bio-enhanced. They're cherry-picked from mercenary groups like the Wagner Group and others, they enter the catacombs looking for her. And they find a way, without giving away too much, they find a way to track her and follow her to her friend. And so it's a real cat and mouse game. And I think it's what was really interesting is I could weave together what's known about these tunnels and actual places and actual sites that people have visited with some flights of fantasy, not fantasy, but fancy. And that's where we are.
Yeah, and talk about atmospheric writing. You really take us down there to the point that I'm now a little bit claustrophobic. When I was younger, I could have I did go down and you know, have the tour years ago. Today, I couldn't do it. And in the book, I was sometimes like gasping for air. And it's so exciting. There are points in this book where it is so exciting. We're on, you know, we're just on a race here. And it gets so exciting. All the characters that are, you know, that you bring out, well, they're all so interesting. But Uncle Cali is the one that, you know, I relate to. I really enjoy reading about her. And I tell you, around page 300, there is a epic fight scene. It has to be one of the best choreographed fight scenes. And I think you'll know the one. It's I don't want to say who's fighting who, but it's around.
Is this from the water?
I tell you, it is so. It's beautifully choreographed. I mean, you have to. How did you work it all out? Did you sort of get up out of your chair and say, "I'm moving here. I'm moving here. I'm moving there."
You know, it's funny. I really in the last few years. I've gotten into choreographing these scenes. You know, I really started watching some of these movies. Like, became a huge fan of the John Wick movies, and thought about, was blown away by the way they do it. You know, and the way they've broken new ground. They've really, it's essentially what you know, Keanu Reeves and company did when they started doing these Wick movies was they looked at, you know, the action genre and they said, well, you know, if it's going to be action, let's just take action to the max. And that's what they did. They just broke all the rules. And I think that really influenced me. And so beginning with really Attack Protocol, the second book in the series, I started really thinking about choreographing action scenes and just playing them out in my mind. And you know, we often look at them, we think of the action as kind of, you know, in a summary fashion, this happened, that happened. But within it, if you break it down in terms of millisecond to millisecond, moment to moment, what's going on, what's happening in this person's head, what's happening in that person's head, how does one bounce off the other, what is the, not only how do they react to each other, but what's happening in the space that they're in, you know, and I think if I have the right scene in mind, there's a lot going on, and it's just a matter of sort of at that point, you know, thinking it through, putting yourself in that space as much as you can. I will say that throughout this book, I rarely knew how she was going to get out of trouble until she ultimately figured it out for me. I honestly was just, I was going by the seat of my pants for a lot of it.
Well, luckily,
and I think that's great. I think that shows.
It is. And luckily, she carries a very interesting weapon, a Japanese weapon. Do you happen to have one?
I don't actually own one, no, but I have researched Japanese martial arts and Japanese weaponry. And I have throughout my life played around with some and of these weapons.
So the Manriki, which is really nice. When I was doing kickboxing, my instructor had one. It is a chain that the police actually use them in Japan to capture people. You know, like criminals, they can actually use it They wrap it around their leg to stop them. So
yeah, if there are some of these people that are so incredibly skilled at using that chain that it's almost it's incredible to watch them. So yeah. And you know the thing is that it takes so long, obviously, to master something like that. That I'm sure that some of these people go through tremendous pain before they can actually inflict pain on the bad guys or the good guys.
Or gals, because there are some...
Or gals, yeah.
Oh, let's not leave the women out of this one. Boy, oh boy.
Well, we're speaking to guys.
I know. Don't worry about it. Not going to get politically correct here. Yes, but you are really good at writing about bad women. I mean, there's some evil going afoot there.
Yeah, I like writing female characters. And it's really interesting because, you know, years ago I wrote a series of what they call in the trade cozies, which are some kind of comedic mysteries, as I'm sure you know. And back then, and even I think to this day, there was really a sense in the publishing industry that a male writer couldn't write a cozy that was written, in many instances, they're written first, most instances, they're first-person mysteries, and are written from a woman's perspective. Usually the lead character is female. And I wrote one of these under a pseudonym, actually two series under a pseudonym. And I never saw, I mean, you know, people are people, and hopefully we all know members of the opposite sex, and I never saw a problem with it. But so for me, it's really easy to kind of write from, and interesting to write from a female point of view, and also I just like badass women.
Boy, oh boy, you've got some of the best, ones, absolutely. You know, it's so, for me, it's so thrilling when I read these, and I get so excited. And with this scene, and there are a couple other scenes where it's like, you know, I see it as a movie in my head, but when I get to the scene, I actually, this scene, because it was so intense, I mean, really intense, and it kept going, and I, at one point, I'm closing my eyes, like, I don't want to see it, then I have to open my eyes, I'm saying, I'm reading a book, for goodness sakes, that's how intense it was.
You know, one thing about my actual writing of this story, I wrote it, my father had just passed away, passed away just after I started writing the book. That coincided with the big Omicron wave, and in fact, when he was hospitalized in his last days, the visiting protocols were changing by the day. So, and I was alone with him in that, in his final hours, and they were pretty difficult. I was in New York. I came back to Maine, and it was December, middle of the winter. So here we were all in, you know, I was kind of in double or triple isolation and dealing with all of this and knowing I had a book to write. So I think that Collie's journey through those catacombs or tunnels beneath Paris, I don't want to get too heavy about it, but for me they were kind of metaphor. I know you picked up. I have all these little references to T.S. Eliot in the book, and some of them are playful, and some of them are kind of really bouncing off his poem The Wasteland, and that, you know, anyone who's read that, and to me, it's one of the greatest poems of the 20th century. That really is kind of describes the fractured nature of what I was going through and what I think the world was and is going through. Again, I don't want to get too heavy-handed, but all of these things really seep into me, and I think that when writing about Kali, there was that sense throughout the whole, what was propelling her through all of this was friendship, the love of a friend. That's really what was driving her, and that was what was going to get her through. And I think if going through the story again, I don't want to give too much away, but she runs into these people who pop up in this world beneath the world, and there were two. I'll just name them. I'm not going to say much about them, but one is Jacques and one is Gilles, Jack and Jill, and that's not their real names, presumably, but those are the names that they give her. And I didn't expect those two to be in the story. I didn't know anything about them at first. And as you know, they became major major characters. There's a character called Etienne, who she meets and Kali runs into him, and he really needs help. He's lost, and she finds him. Yeah. And again, I'm not going to give much more away, but that, you know, all of that, the kind of people pulling together in these dark circumstances, that the need for friendship to get through, that was kind of a running theme, and whether it was conscious or not, I don't know, but it was certainly a running theme that I realized evolved as the book went on.
Well, yeah, I was going to mention Etienne because it was so, I was so happy when you introduced him. It was sort of, you know, we're in the tunnel, we're sort of gasping for air, and then we meet him, and it was so refreshing. And I right away recognized, oh, this is a great character. Now, Jerome, I have to take a commercial break. But we're going to come back. We're going to talk more about this book, and perhaps you'll explain a little bit. We'll talk about maybe the White Rose. You decide what you want to tell people. I'm going to play a book buzz. This is one of the promo that we do. Did she call in? I'm just asking Big Ed. Okay. Big Ed in the control room is waiting in case Eugenia Lovett West calls in, but we'll play a book buzz and some commercials, and then I'll be right back with Jerome Preisler, and we're going to be talking about NetForce Moving Target.
Hey everyone, it's Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety Talk Clock children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. A lively celebration of friendship and music is here for readers to enjoy. The Animal Song, written and illustrated by Jaunty Howley, is here. A crocodile, a big brown bear, and a weasel form a traveling band and play for the other animals in the woods. But when winter comes, the animals in the woods head to bed, leaving the traveling band to find a new audience to hear their sound. Jaunty first sketched the main characters back in 2019. While waiting to hear if his story would get published, he made models of the characters from the story to calm his nerves. Having a lot of fun making them, the book eventually got published. While being a story, The Animal Song is also, well, a song, with original music composed by the author and illustrator himself, Jaunty Howley. Perhaps when you read The Animal Song, maybe you'll also sing along. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's Book Buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3255. 3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my guest, Jerome Preisler, and we are talking about his new book, Net Force, Moving Target, and we're also going to be talking about some of his other books, but during the break, I had a message, so Jerome, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, great. Eugenia Lovett West sent me a text, and she's not going to be able to call in. She had an appointment this morning, and she's not back yet. But she's wants me to tell all my listeners how much she appreciates hearing from them and all of their best wishes that they've been sending her, because she is such a wonderful, wonderful woman. As I said, she just turned 100 last week.
Happy 100th, Eugenia.
She is really an amazing person. I love her. We talked the other day about... this is so wonderful when you're that age and you can talk about, she can talk about D-Day like it was yesterday. She knows, remembers all the details. She remembers everything. And as I mentioned to you, a few years ago, what happened is a friend of hers was a victim of identity theft. And she had never really thought about that. And, you know, her friend was quite senior and she was really angry about it. And she decided... she writes mystery stories. She has a series, and she also writes historical books about the Revolutionary War. But she was so upset about the cybercrime that she decided to do research. She did research, and she wrote a mystery called Firewall about cybercrime.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it fantastic when you're 98 years old?
Amazing.
And you're doing that kind of research, and then you publish a book, and it's a really fine book. So... Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a wonderful thing about being a writer. You can keep going and going and going.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Even as parts break down, as long as you can find a chair and you don't even really need to be able to see your screen, you can just dictate. So you're okay.
And it gives hope for everybody. You know, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. She is an inspiration because she started writing when she was, you know, quite senior, and she's had, you know, like eight books, I think, now. And she's got one more coming out at the end of the year. So this is always so exciting for me when I get to talk to her. As a matter of fact, we were talking about The Automat the other day because there was a documentary on television about automats. And, of course, she remembers automats.
Actually, so do I. I remember the Horn and Hardart in New York, which I went to when I was very young. And... I'm not saying anything about what I'm working on. That's still classified, but I actually have a scene in something I'm writing that takes place in the 1940s in an automat. So there.
Wow. What?
Yeah, there you go.
Isn't that something? What a connection.
I want to get back to something you said, because these connections can be so interesting. Just before you went to the break, you mentioned the white rose. And Moving Target was originally supposed to come out around Christmas, but I was given, through the good grace of my publisher, an extra couple of months to finish the book. And we changed the pub date to February 21st. February 22nd, which was yesterday, was the sad anniversary, the tragic anniversary of the execution of Sophie Magdalena Scholl and her brother Hans, who founded the White Rose. The White Rose is a group that you just mentioned, and I thought, wow, it blew me away when I realized I had not remembered the date that they were killed. Just to explain why we're talking about this and why you mentioned it, the White Rose was a group of students, and if I may, I'd just like to name them, because there were only a small handful. They were all executed by the Nazis during World War II in 1943. None were older than in their very early 20s. Sophie Magdalena was 21. It was Sophie and Hans, her brother Hans, their friend Christoph Kraus, Alexander Schmorell, Willy Graf, and I hope I'm getting his name, his second name right, Kurt Huber. Sophie, Hans, and Christoph were arrested by the Gestapo for distributing anti-Nazi flyers at their university, at Sophie's university, the University of Munich, on February 18th, 1943. And 4 days later, she was marched to the guillotine and beheaded for this horrible infraction, and also for having written the word freedom spray-painted the word freedom on some walls. She was arrested after having gone up to a balcony at the university and tossed a bunch of flyers. I think the sixth or seventh flyer that she and her brother had made up, and was spotted doing this by a janitor who was a dedicated Nazi. I refer people to the internet to just look up her story, because it's tremendously moving. And the way it ties into Moving Target is that, beginning with the prequel for the whole series, which is a novella called Eye of the Drone, I connect Colleen, our heroine, to a group called the White Rose, and which was the name of the group that Sophie and her brother started. And it's in fact, there is a connection that goes through all these 80 years from 1943 to actually slightly in our future, which is when NetForce takes place. And there's this very powerful connection to Kali that finally becomes, that I finally explain and is fleshed out in the current book. So I'm glad you brought that up, because that to me has been a really important thread. And I was just blown away by the fact that the book came out almost 80 years to the day after Sophie's...
I thought you had deliberately done it. I thought you had selected that date for the release deliberately.
No. Isn't that incredible? It's just wild.
It's one of these strange golden threads that run through everything. Because I've actually been to the Geschwister Scholplatz, which is in Munich University. I've been there I used to have a store.
How did it feel to be there? Actually being
I cried a lot I cried a lot of times when I was in Germany, but I actually owned a shop in Munich, so I was there quite often. And
you can relate to some of the other stuff in the book as well.
Oh, yes. Very much.
There's a shop in Munich there, too.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah. Wow. So it was one of my confectionery. I owned a franchise of confectionery stores that I owned. And I had one in Munich, and so I was there quite often. So, and I was at the Platz where, you know, and when you think about it, and you sort of just casually mentioned she was guillotined. Most people don't realize that the Nazis had, I think, 20 or 30 of these guillotines, and they were using them all the time. I think they beheaded as many people as occurred in the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm. That's accurate. In fact, place where she was held was a, I forget what it was converted from, but it was it was made into a prison, and that's where they guillotined people, and there's a whole graveyard there of people who were just executed by the Nazis for absolutely ridiculous reasons in many instances. The judge who sentenced her, and again it was a kangaroo court. And he was this guy who wore red robes and made a whole show out of it. And she was 21 years old and was unyielding. Her final words, I wish I had them in front of me, but her final words were just full of courage.
Well, so the connection and connecting this to your story, the White Rose and your story and how it's sort of all connecting here with Kali. And it's fascinating how you've done it. It's a complicated story. It's a big story. And you write about, this is a 1 year of it's not easy. It's like what Nathaniel Hawthorne says, easy reading is damn hard writing.
Yeah, what I tried to do with this series is really do a lot of world building, and I very deliberately I had it I conceived it the first four books as being a single arc, what I said to you a few minutes ago is very accurate, that when I write the book I don't know how I'm going to get my characters out of whatever fixes I get them into, and it's just if I'm surprised, then it's going to surprise the reader. But I do have a master plan, and that changes. It's very dynamic. But I have one, and so it is a big kind of complicated world. And I start out with Dark Web, again the first novel, where it looks a lot more like our world. A lot of the stuff that exists around the edges that I know are there, I only hint at in the first book. But when we get to this book, I really was looking toward a second arc, and so everything kind of explodes here. And I think we don't have time to talk about it now, but there's a lot of interesting stuff with AI that. To use your term, the golden thread, the book comes out, and no sooner, I think the same day it came out or the day before, I'm reading the Times, and I don't know if you've read this conversation between this New York Times tech writer and Sydney, which is the AI that's been developed by Microsoft.
Yes.
Did you read that?
Yes.
And I don't want to leave listeners in the dark, this is a big topic of conversation, but essentially this writer sits down to kind of just have a conversation with this AI that's been developed by Microsoft to as a huge component of its search engine, and over the course of 2 hours the conversation takes a really dark turn that was so unsettling to the guy who wrote it, who wrote the piece, that he couldn't sleep that night. And if you read the article, it's in the Times, he's got a link to the full transcript of their conversation, and you can see where it really just veers off into the abyss. And at times he's trying to pull back, he's trying to pull this very weird AI back to like what it's supposed to be, which is, you know, he's asking it, well, if I want to buy a lawnmower, what would be my best option? And it'll say things like, it'll give him the options, but then it'll circle back to, do you realize I love you? I'm paraphrasing, but it's a very, very, very disturbing thing.
It is. It's weird and disturbing and frightening.
It really is. And that was something that I've been, I've actually been reading a lot about and working into the series. And again, some of it comes to fruition in this book. And really, I'm only even scratching the surface of what, you know, where it would go. But so it is. It's complicated, but it's all kind of, you know, there's a lot going on around us, and it just things seep in. And you just, you know, you get your idea for a story, and then all of a sudden, it's like while you get your idea, you read something or something happens in the world, and it just can't help but filter its way through.
That's true. And now, one of the things we could also call this an international thriller, because indeed, it's not just Paris that's involved. We have to talk about this too, because I just love this, another section of the book. But you also have the Crimea, which, you know, is in the news now constantly. We don't know what's going to happen in the Crimea. So there's so much international intrigue, world intrigue. Who's planning to do what? And so it's a wonderful, beautifully layered story.
Yeah, and you know, here's another thing. When I wrote the part of the story that takes place in Crimea, I had actually set that up at the end of the previous book. And this was long before the current Russian invasion. And so here, while I'm writing Moving Target, and the invasion occurs in the midst of everything else, that some of the personal things I told you about and the pandemic, we have the invasion, and I've already set part of the story in Crimea ahead of time, so I'm actually writing about certain things, or rather integrating things that are happening in real time into the book as I write them, which is to say, what the Wagner Group does when they become part of this whole horrible scenario. So there was this interesting feedback between what I was doing in reality, and it just kept going and going and going. And I've never written a book where it's been that immediate. I'm really glad you brought that up, because I don't want to kind of short shrift that part of the story, which is an extremely which features our, you know, that's real, the focus on that is in that part of the story is on my other star character, Mike Carmody, and I think that storyline is equally interesting. It is,
and that's why I say I love the layers. I love that we have, well, there's a lot of tension everywhere, but it is broken up a little bit. I love this. Should I mention the card playing, or does that give away anything?
We can talk about it. Why not?
I want to know if do you do card tricks?
I do not do card tricks, but. Again, I'll try to make this as succinct as possible. If we go back to the Wasteland, there is a segment in which Eliot writes about the tarot cards, and I started thinking about sort of the connection between magic, stage magic, which involves a lot of misdirection, and hacking. Specifically phishing, phishing, which also involves misdirection. And since Kali is a master hacker and has conducted phishing operations in the series, I started wondering about whether Kali might have some card tricks up her sleeve. Well, I'm not going to say any more other than when I decided to work it into the book, I, through a friend, serendipitously met someone named Peter Bois, who I thank in the book. Peter is a professional stage magician who coincidentally lives in Maine, so he and I met, and Peter really helped me work on that scene. I basically laid it on his lap. I said, here's what I want. Can you give me any tips? So if that scene works, here's a big shout out to Peter, because it was really Peter Bois' idea, you know, all of that.
Oh, it works. It works. I love it. I thought that was it's so good. It's, you know, I love the big fight scene around the, you know, page 300, and then when I, you know, everything else in between, and then when I get to the card one, well, we'll let readers get to that point. You'll love it. It's fascinating. I thought it was beautifully written and so interesting. And I think everybody after that is going to the internet and trying to, you know, just learn some card tricks. So I think he's inspired people.
And well, thank you. You know, it's interesting because here we are. This kind of encapsulates the book. We're talking about, you know, Crimea, the tunnels beneath Paris, card tricks. We didn't mention robot dog, but that's all I'm going to say about that.
Yeah,
robot dog.
That's enough, yes.
We'll leave it there. Patsy, is it okay if I do a quick shout-out to someone?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Oh, okay. I want to give a say hello to someone who's listening, and it's Liz Malone, and it's my new publicist, and you've had an exchange or two with her, and she says hello. And the reason I'm mentioning Liz, besides the fact that she's just a great human being, is that she has really turned around, my writing career in a million different ways, and has helped me understand or helped me really navigate what is an emerging and difficult landscape for all writers. And since this show is about writers, I think it's important for writers to at some point for us to discuss what it really takes to break through the noise these days, because it's getting increasingly difficult. And so I just wanted to say hi to Liz and thank her.
Okay, publicly. Absolutely. And I think is Steve Hartov with her too?
Yes, in fact, that's how I met her. Steve and I, again, here we go. Steve and I met online. Turns out we're with the same publisher. We have the same editor, which I didn't know. He didn't know. We have all these other connections, agents, editors, blah, blah, blah. And it turns out that both our mothers came from Austria during the Holocaust. So there.
And the golden thread that connects us is that we're all interested in the same type of books. I loved Stephen, The Last of the Seven.
An amazing book.
And so it's wonderful. You know, I am so glad that I didn't speak to you on Pub Day, because I wouldn't have had enough time. But this way I've had plenty of time. Well, not enough time, actually. I wish the program was 2 hours. I'd keep you another hour.
I feel like we're just getting started. I'm just getting warmed up here. I'll just keep talking off the air.
I know. It sounds good to me, because it's just, I'm just so happy that we had this opportunity to spend a whole hour today and talk about this book. Everybody, it's really, it's just a wonderful read. And especially for all of you people who are going to be stuck in the snow. Because I understand there's some bad weather heading to everybody up north. This is a perfect
it's
book.
Here. It's already here, Patsy.
Okay. Well, everybody, get this book. It's going to be a lot of fun to read. And Jerome, you are just fantastic. You're writing. We didn't even get to talk about. Well, okay. First of all, everybody, the new book is NetForce Moving Target. Get it now and read it this weekend. You'll just have so much fun. and lots of things to find out there. And of course, I can't let you go without mentioning, of course, Civil War Commando, because that's the one my listeners often ask me about and that I recommend. And it's Civil War Commando, William Cushing and the Daring Raid to Sink the Ironclad CSS Albemarle. And I love that book too. Jerome, thank you so much. You are always a joy to talk to.
Patsy, you are amazing, and it's just been a pleasure.
Well, it's been a joy to talk to you. Stay warm up there, and I'm sure you're writing.
What else can I do?
That's it.
And shovel snow.
That's it. Okay. Bye-bye now, Jerome.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Oh, what a treat. A whole hour with Jerome. That's what I call a real treat. And again, the new book is fascinating. It's lots of fun. And I did when I went twice into that underground of Paris. And it's, as I said, I couldn't do it today. The thought of being underground would just make me crazy. But it is a great tour if you ever go to Paris. Many people don't realize that you can go down there and they take you down to the tunnels. And now it's funny. When I was young, I wasn't scared. Today, you couldn't get me down there. Oh, well, maybe if I had a few. My favorite drink when I was in Paris was Cure Royale. I used to drink a lot of that. If I had a few Cure Royale, I could go down and walk around but I couldn't do it today. Anyway, and I'm not even sure I could take Paris right now until it's too sad. But anyway, that was fun, and the book is lots of fun. It's just I really enjoy it. It's a multi-layered story, and as I said, it reflects a little bit on the times and gives us a lot of things to think about. So I was very happy that I was able to have this time with Jerome today. I want to remind you that Bill Larson is coming up next week. It's next week? Yes, I guess it's next week. My goodness, the month has gone so fast already. It's the 23rd. Wow. Anyway, he's going to be here. If you have intellectual property questions, send them to me, and I will ask him to answer them for you. And then anything else? Nope. Just go to my website, radio-joyonpaper.com. I've got a lot of new stuff up there. Anyway, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry. And, well, this week I want Witch City Mysteries because book number 13 is pretty darn good, I can tell you. My sister won't let me read it. She's got it. But I will read it. Anyway, everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful time this weekend, and say something nice to somebody. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Big Ed, thank you so much, and thank you for everything you do, and have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Bye-bye now.